very pleased to introduce Professor Michael Bergman from Purdue, and I've been really fascinated by his work on common sense beliefs, and reading epistemology, and skeptical theism, and now we're going to hear about epistemic intuitions and the fetus for non-inferential beliefs.
Thank you. Thanks to John and the team for inviting me for hosting this event. It's been great to hear all these other papers. I have a handout. Has it been circulated? Yeah, it's a painful handout because it's got a lot of words on it. Here, maybe. Yeah, I'll let you pass it around. There's a whole stack being circulated here. I'm sorry, maybe I should not grab them all. Okay, well, I'm going to be reading this paper, and I'll try to signal from time to time where we are in the handout if you're having difficulty following. This is part, it's a first attempt to capture one of the main ideas of this book that I've been working on for too long, because I've been distracted by other things. So I very much would like to get your feedback, which I hope would help me to improve it. So, the goal of this paper is to explain how religious belief, in particular, non-inferential religious belief, can be rational despite the threat of defeaters. I begin in section one with some general remarks about defeaters and responses to them. Then in section two, I focus on some non-religious, non-inferential beliefs and explain how they can handle potential defeaters, highlighting the role of epistemic intuitions in both the challenge provided by defeaters and in what I think are the best responses to such challenges. In section three, I show how non-inferential religious beliefs can be defended against defeaters in precisely the same way. So section one, as I'm thinking of them, defeaters are mental states, just as I think of evidence as consisting of mental states. This is because defeaters are a kind of evidence, negative evidence. Evidence is what our rational beliefs are based on, and rational beliefs are based on things such as other beliefs, memorial and a priori seemings, moral intuitions, and perceptual experiences. And in fact, any conscious mental state, including a doubt or withholding, can be evidence, for we can base a rational belief on it, namely the belief that that's the mental state that we're in. At least partially based on that, maybe. Defeaters are mental states in response to which it's rational to give up a belief or hold it less firmly. Thus, any conscious mental state can be a defeater, since it can be that in response to which it's rational to give up the belief that I've never been in that sort of mental state. There are other uses of evidence, for example, to refer to an object such as a bloody knife that's presented at a trial in a court of law, or to refer to a proposition that confirms or best explains hypothesis. I'm not using the term in any of these ways, but the sense of evidence I'm employing in this paper, where it refers to the grounds of our beliefs, especially our rational beliefs, is a standard one. I think it's the kind of view that Feldman and Coney would endorse, and they count as evidentialists, and so they have I defer to them at least in that, a little bit on that. Likewise, there are other uses of defeater, for example, to refer to a true proposition such that if a person believed it, some other justified belief that person has would cease to be justified or would become less justified. And this is the kind of defeater that Ed was mentioning in connection with the no defeater conditions on to solve the Gettier problem. But the sense of defeater which I'm using in this paper is also, I think, a standard one. Sort of annoying to be told over and over again that defeaters can be rebutting or undercutting. I'll just mention that again anyways. Rebutting defeaters for a belief are reasons to think. So I'm going to draw a distinction between rebutting and undercutting defeaters for inferential beliefs and also for non-inferential beliefs. So a rebutting defeater for an inferential belief, such as a belief held on the basis of an argument, is a reason to think the conclusion of that inference or argument is false. An undercutting defeater for such a belief is a reason for thinking that believing on the basis of that inference or argument isn't a trustworthy way to form a belief, perhaps because believing one of the premises is false or not well supported, or because the premises don't support the conclusion inferred from them. Our focus will be on non-inferential belief, though, where the belief is not held on the basis of other beliefs, but instead on the basis of non-doxastic mental states, such as sensory experiences, memory impressions, a priori seemings, or moral intuitions, where these impressions, seemings, and intuitions aren't beliefs. Some people think of intuitions as beliefs. I think of them as, you know, as kind of like an intuitive seeming. Here, too, rebutting defeaters are reasons for thinking the beliefs in question are false. Undercutting defeaters are reasons for thinking the non-inferential beliefs aren't reliably formed or held, perhaps because the mental states on which the beliefs are based aren't good evidence for the beliefs, or aren't reliable indicators of the belief's truth, at least in the particular circumstances in which the beliefs are formed or held. What's required for a belief to avoid defeat from a proposed defeater isn't that the skeptic proposing the defeater is satisfied by responses in defense of the belief. Rather, what's required is that it's false that the rational response in the believer's circumstances to the proposed defeater is to give up the targeted belief. Even in cases where the skeptic is not satisfied by the believer's responses to the skeptic's worries, it's possible that the skeptic's proposed defeater fails to make it rational for the believer to give up her belief, and for that reason, fails to function as a defeater for the belief. What matters for epistemic defeat is not what the skeptic finds satisfying, but what rationality in fact requires. Okay, so section 2a. Skeptical objections and potential defeaters. Skeptical objections are potential defeaters. Arguments for skepticism concerning our perceptual beliefs about the external world are of this sort. I will focus not on rebutting objections, which argue that our perceptual beliefs are false, but on undercutting ones, which argue that our perceptual beliefs aren't formed in a trustworthy way. Consider the underdetermination objection to our perceptual beliefs. It begins by noting that these beliefs are not based on arguments or inferences. Instead, they are non-inferential perceptual beliefs based on sensory experiences that don't guarantee the truth of these beliefs. Because they don't guarantee truth, we could have these sensory experiences whether or not there is an external physical world, and whether or not the external world is the way these experiences incline us to think that world is. The worry is easy to understand. If our perceptual evidence could be the same whether or not the external world is as we are inclined to think it is on the basis of that evidence, then that evidence underdetermines the truth of our beliefs. One natural response is to seek out arguments, ones that don't rely on perceptual evidence, for the conclusion that our perceptual evidence makes it probable that our perceptual beliefs are true. There are good reasons for thinking that such arguments aren't available. I won't rehearse those reasons here. So I have in mind things that Alston and Fumerton have written about non-circularly defending the reliability of perception. Exactly parallel worries plague our memory beliefs, which are non-inferential beliefs based on memory impressions or seemings. That's how I'm understanding them. These memory seemings don't guarantee the truth of those beliefs. We could have the same memory seemings that in fact provide the evidential basis for our memory beliefs, whether or not there was a past, and whether or not the past was the way this memory evidence inclines us to think it was. Our memory evidence, therefore, underdetermines the truth of our memory beliefs, and we don't have any good arguments that don't rely on memory evidence for thinking that our memory evidence makes it probable that our memory beliefs are true. Again, appealing to Alston and Fumerton sort of considerations. These underdetermination objections to our non-inferential perceptual and memory beliefs are potential undercutting defeaters for those beliefs. The question thus arises, how can these perceptual memory beliefs avoid being defeated, given that no good arguments are available for defending those beliefs inferentially against these underdetermination objections? So section B, it's kind of a longer section and sort of a key section, I guess, one of the key sections of the paper. In my view, the best response to this sort of skeptical worry about perception and memory is a two-step reading and response that both relies on and responds to epistemic intuitions. The first step in this response is to highlight the strong epistemic intuitions we have that address the skeptical worries in question. I developed this first step using the work of Thomas Reed and a more recent philosopher, William Tolhurst. The second step is to point out that both the skeptical objections and the Reedian response rely on epistemic intuitions, but the skeptical objections rely on epistemic intuitions that are weaker than, and for that reason, overridden by the stronger epistemic intuitions employed in the Reedian response to the skeptical objection. So now I'm on the part that says first step. Let's start by considering what Reed says on this topic. He notes that it's a first principle that our faculties are reliable. First principles, says Reed, are properly believed non-inferentially. Just as we have non-inferential beliefs about our immediate physical environments, our immediate physical environment by means of sense perception, and about our past by means of memory, so also we have a faculty of common sense by means of which we form non-inferential beliefs in first principles. How exactly does this faculty of common sense produce beliefs in first principles? According to Reed, quote, we may observe that opinions which contradict first principles are distinguished from other errors by this, that they're not only false but absurd. And to discountenance absurdity, nature has given us a particular emotion, to wit, that of ridicule, which seems intended for this very purpose of putting out of countenance what is absurd, either in opinion or practice. This from a man who was an occasionalist. That was not part of the paper, but anyways. The suggestion is that when you entertain the contrary of a first principle, for example, the principle that your faculties are reliable, you experience the emotion of ridicule. On the basis of this experience, you dismiss as absurd the contrary of the first principle and believe the first principle itself. Thus, non-inferential common sense belief in the reliability of your faculties is like non-inferential perceptual belief in that both are based on experiential evidence. The emotion of ridicule in the former case and sensory experience in the latter case. You might think there's a little bit of an inference going on there, and maybe there is, but you can, I think, also describe it so there isn't. Okay, similar points have been made by William Tolhurst, in a different context by William Tolhurst, when he tries to capture the essence of seemings as follows. And again, I'm quoting, the real difference between seemings and other states that can incline one to believe their content is that seemings have the feel of truth, the feel of a state whose content reveals how things really are. Their felt givenness leads one to experience believing that things are as they seem, as an objectively fitting, their felt givenness typically leads one to experience believing that things are as they seem, as an objective fitting or proper response to that seeming. When I merely think about a cat in my yard, or imagine this to be the case, or desire that it be the case, my mental state does not have this feel. So he's really just trying to capture what seemings are. That was his effort here. Tolhurst calls this feeling of a state whose content reveals how things really are, its felt veridicality. It is the distinguishing feature, he thinks, of seemings. He goes on to speak of a higher order awareness of this felt veridicality. And again, I'm quoting. Felt veridicality can also ground a felt demand that one form a second-order belief about the seeming. In calling the feeling of felt veridicality to mind, one reflects on one's experience and considers how they feel. This generates a second-order seeming in which the seeming is itself the object of a seeming. When we become self-consciously aware of a seeming, it seems to us that the seeming is veridical. This second-order seeming is grounded in our awareness of the feel of veridicality. So, according to Reed, when a person considers the thought that her beliefs formed on the basis of seemings, for example, her simple perceptual or memory beliefs, are unreliably formed, she will find that thought absurd and believe instead that they are reliably formed. Another way to put this is that it will first seem absurd to her that they are unreliably formed, and it will then seem that they are reliably formed, and she'll believe that. Tolhurst says something similar. When we consider, for example, a memory seeming that P, we become aware of its felt veridicality, and this makes it seem to us that the memory seeming that P is veridical. On the basis of this higher order seeming, we believe that the memory belief that P, based on that memory seeming that P, is formed in a reliable and non-misleading way, contrary to the skeptical possibility that, according to the objector, should make us have doubts. Okay, so now I'm moving on to the part that's epistemic intuitions and particularism. These higher order seemings that are first order beliefs are reliably formed, or that our first order seemings are veridical, are examples of epistemic intuitions. Epistemic intuitions are like moral intuitions, which are seemings about moral matters, the difference being that epistemic intuitions are seemings about epistemic matters. I'll just leave it. Some examples. I can talk about some examples later if you want. Both are normative seemings. Just as one can have moral intuitions about particular cases or about mid-level principles or higher-level principles, so also One can have epistemic intuitions about particular cases or mid-level principles or higher-level principles. The reading response to the underdetermination objection to our perceptual memory beliefs relies on epistemic intuitions. The skeptical objection raises doubts about the reliability of our perceptual and memory beliefs or about the veridicality of our sensory experience or our perceptual or memory seemings. The reading reply is to reject those doubts and affirm the reliability of those beliefs and the veridicality of the seemings on which they're based. In doing this, the reading reply is forming a higher level belief about the trustworthiness of our faculties, and this higher level belief is based on epistemic intuitions. As already noted, the epistemic intuitions can be about either general principles, such as that we epistemically should trust our faculties because they're reliable, or particular cases, such as that my belief that I have a hand is rational and formed in a trustworthy way. Responses to skepticism in this reading or common sense vein have been championed by many since the time of Reid. And I would put in this category G.E. Moore and Chisholm, but also Jim Pryor and John Greco. They might dispute some of the description of how they do things, but I would think of it as being in this category. Chisholm cites the Reidian response to Humean skeptical worries as a paradigm instance of a view he calls particularism. Thank you. Okay, second step, that's where we're at now. So I guess that's on the second page of the handout. Oh no, I'm sorry, we're not quite there. I got one paragraph left in the particularism thing. So Chisholm cites the Reidian response to Humean skeptical worries as a paradigm instance of a view he called particularism. The Humean skeptic believes an epistemic principle saying that we can't know anything about the external world or the past unless we have strong arguments for our conclusions, arguments beginning with premises about our current sensory experience. Reid recognized that such a principle implies that we don't have any knowledge about the external world or the past, since no strong arguments of that kind are available. But Reid thought it was clear that we do have knowledge of the existence of the external world in the past. As a result, Reid and Moore and others in this tradition reject the epistemic principle on which the Humean skeptical argument depends. This is the particularist response to the Humean skeptical, to the Humean skepticism described in this paragraph. It's called a particularist response because it gives more weight to the epistemic intuitions supporting judgments about the epistemic status of particular beliefs than to the epistemic intuition supporting general epistemic principles of the sort that are employed in skeptical objections. So now, second step. What I want to highlight is that in making this response, the Reidian particularist is doing the same sort of thing that the skeptic is doing. After all, how does the skeptic know that her epistemic principles are true? Presumably, the epistemic principles on which the skeptic relies in proposing her skeptical objections are believed on the basis of epistemic intuitions. Indeed, just as it's hard to see how moral beliefs can be justified without relying in some way, at some point, on moral intuitions, it's also difficult to see how skeptical arguments for epistemic conclusions about what we epistemically shouldn't believe can be justified without relying in some way, at some point, on epistemic intuitions. The Reidian can concede that there may be some initial appeal to the epistemic intuitions on which skeptical objections rely, but she goes on to insist that the strength of these skepticism-inducing epistemic intuitions pales in comparison to the strength of the epistemic intuitions in support of the rationality of particular beliefs and in support of the reliability or veridicality of the belief-forming faculties that produce them. Putting all this in terms of defeaters, what we have is the following situation. I form my non-inferential perceptual and memory beliefs. Then I become aware of the underdetermination objection, a skeptical objection suggesting that I should be doubtful of the reliability of these perceptual and memory beliefs. This is a proposed defeater for these beliefs, and it is based, at least in part, on epistemic intuitions. For example, the intuition that I should withhold judgment about the reliability of my beliefs based on evidence that doesn't guarantee their truth, at least until I've got an argument that those beliefs are made probable by that evidence. But when I consider the higher level claim that my perceptual memory beliefs aren't formed in a trustworthy way, I have the strong higher level seeming that this is false, and that in fact it can be in individual cases, but in that my perceptual memory beliefs are formed in a trustworthy way. On the basis of this epistemic intuition, I deny the claim that they're unreliably formed, and I deny further the skeptic's premise that in light of the underdetermination objection, I epistemically should be doubtful about or withhold my perceptual memory beliefs. In short, this proposed defeater is deflected by my reliance on epistemic intuitions, ones that are stronger than the epistemic intuitions supporting the defeater. As a result, my perceptual and memory beliefs avoid being defeated by the skeptical objection. So I use deflected there instead of, the point isn't that my perception gets to be defeated by these arguments and then I reinstate it. It's rather that it gets to be, there's a proposed defeater and it gets deflected, and so there's never any defeat. I guess one thing that does get defeated, if you at first believe this principle used by the skeptic, and then this might be a kind of defeater for that principle if you had at first believed it. Okay, moreover, although epistemologists can explain in some detail how this happens by mentioning the sorts of things that I've said above and by developing these remarks at some length, this reading and response works just as well for the philosophically naive. So for example, an ordinary person might watch the movie The Matrix for the first time. And as she walks out of the theater, she might consider the possibility that her perceptual and memory beliefs are massively unreliable. And she might wonder how she could rule out this possibility. She might even wonder if it's sensible for her to continue trusting her memory and her sensory experience. But it might happen almost as soon as she considers this worry that she dismisses it as implausible and affirms to herself that it would be silly to be skeptical in that way on the basis of those kinds of concerns about her perception and her memory. This ordinary person would be responding to the underdetermination objection in basically the same way that Reed is, despite the fact that she wouldn't describe her response in the way I've been describing the Reedian response. Okay, section C. Proposed defeaters for mathematical and moral beliefs. So let's look next at two kinds of skeptical objection that can be applied to both mathematical and moral belief. The first is the underdetermination objection, which we already talked about. Both simple, non-inferential mathematical beliefs, for example, that 1 and 1 is 2, and simple, non-inferential moral beliefs, for example, that recreational torture of toddlers is morally wrong, are based on a priori intuitions or seemings. It seems strongly to me that these mathematical or moral claims are true, maybe even that they're true of necessity. And on the basis of such seemings, I believe these claims. The problem is that a strong seeming that P, even a strong seeming that P is true of necessity, doesn't guarantee that P is true. For example, the naive comprehension axiom that for every predicate there's a set of things satisfying that predicate has to some people seem strongly to be true of necessity. But Russell's paradox shows us that it's false. And even without this example of an actual case, we can see that it's possible in cases of cognitive malfunction or victimization by a deceptive demon for someone to have an extremely strong seeming that P is true of necessity, despite that the fact that P is not true, and maybe even that's a contingent claim. For this reason, a priori seemings are like sensory experiences and memory impressions in that they underdetermine the truth of the beliefs based on them. Now, I have a footnote dealing with a complication that arises because there won't be cases where you have the seeming for necessary truths and the necessary truths are false. Maybe I'll just leave that and we can come back to it if you want. But I think that's not such a serious worry. I'll just repeat the last sentence. For this reason, a priori seemings are like sensory experiences and memory impressions in that they underdetermine the truth of the beliefs based on them. To deal with this worry, it's natural to seek out arguments for the conclusion that our a priori seemings make it probable that our a priori beliefs are true, arguments that don't rely on our a priori seemings. But again, just as in the case of perceptual memory beliefs, there are good reasons for thinking that such arguments aren't available. Thus, given that our simple, non-inferential, mathematical, and moral beliefs are based on a priori seemings, the underdetermination objection gives a potential defeater for these beliefs in the same way that it provides a potential defeater for our perceptual and memory beliefs. Another objection to our mathematical and moral beliefs is the mystery objection. Here the concern is that it's a mystery how it is that we can detect such facts. In the case of perception, we have a story to tell about how it is that we detect facts about the external world. In vision, for example, light rays reflect off objects and strike our retinas, triggering signals in our optic nerves, which are sent to our brains and result in our forming beliefs about the objects in question. But there's no such story to tell in the case of our mathematical and moral beliefs. Mathematical facts are about abstract objects, which are supposedly immaterial, causally inert things with which we can have no physical contact. objective moral facts are typically thought of as non-natural facts, and it's not at all clear how we are supposed to causally interact with this non-natural realm. According to the mystery objection, because we have very little idea how our minds could be responsive to and detect mathematical or moral facts, we have good reason to wonder if we really can detect them. And until we can explain how we can detect them, we should at least withhold judgment about whether we can detect them. But withholding judgment about whether you can detect facts of a certain kind constitutes a defeater for beliefs you have about such facts, at least in cases where your supposed way of forming such beliefs depends on your having an ability to detect such facts. So the mystery objection provides us with another potential defeater for our mathematical and moral beliefs. Section D. My favorite response to these two proposed defeaters for our mathematical and moral beliefs is more or less the same as the response described above to the proposed underdetermination defeater for our perception and memory beliefs. In the case of a simple non-inferential mathematical belief such as 1 plus 1 equals 2, when I reflect on that belief's content, it seems obviously true and I believe it firmly. When I reflect on that mathematical seeming, I have a higher order seeming that that mathematical seeming is veridical, and that my belief based on it is formed in a trustworthy way. When I consider the underdetermination objection, suggesting that I epistemically should withhold judgment about the reliability of my mathematical seemings, I reject that suggestion as false. I reject it because the epistemic intuition that my belief that 1 plus 1 equals 2 is rational and formed in a trustworthy way is stronger than any epistemic intuitions supporting the underdetermination objection. And when I consider the mystery objection and its suggestion that I epistemically should withhold judgment about mathematical beliefs until I can offer a decent explanation of how I detect mathematical facts, I reject that suggestion as false. Once again, this is because the epistemic intuition that my mathematical belief is rational and formed in a trustworthy way is stronger than any epistemic intuition in support or the premises of the mystery objection. Similar remarks apply to moral beliefs. When I reflect on the claim that recreational torture of toddlers is morally wrong, it seems obviously true, and I believe it. When I reflect on that moral seeming, I have the higher order epistemic seeming that that moral seeming is veridical and that my belief based on it is formed in a trustworthy way. And that epistemic intuition is stronger than any epistemic intuitions in support of either, number one, I think this is on it's the italicized thing on the handout or close to it. The underdetermination objection's suggestion that I epistemically should withhold judgment about the reliability of my moral beliefs until I've got an argument for their reliability that doesn't rely on moral intuitions. And it's also stronger than two, the mystery objection's suggestion that I epistemically should withhold judgment about the moral beliefs until I can offer a decent explanation of how I detect such facts. Given that the higher order epistemic seeming about the veridicality of my moral seeming is stronger, I reject the underdetermination objection and the mystery objection. Moreover, these kinds of responses to these proposed defeaters for moral and mathematical beliefs can be employed by ordinary people who aren't philosophically sophisticated. A person can rely on higher order epistemic seemings to deflect such defeaters without being able to explain that this is what is happening. Thus, just as in the case of perceptual and memory belief, so also in the case of mathematical and moral belief, I can quite sensibly rely on epistemic intuitions about the veridicality of my seemings to deflect potential defeaters motivated by the underdetermination objection. Likewise, I can rely on such epistemic intuitions to deflect potential defeaters associated with the mystery objection. The claim here is not that this sort of response will satisfy the skeptical objector by offering her what she'll consider to be a successful proof that the objection fails. The claim rather is that these beliefs can remain rational in the way noted in the face of these potential defeaters. This is because it's false that in such a situation, rationality requires me to give up those mathematical or moral beliefs. Okay, section E, this is page 3 of the handout. Concerns about epistemic circularity. What happens if a skeptic employs the underdetermination objection and the mystery objection against beliefs formed on the basis of epistemic intuitions? After all, these epistemic intuitions don't guarantee the truth of the beliefs based on them. And it's mysterious how these epistemic intuitions enable us to detect epistemic facts, just as mysterious perhaps as how our mathematical and moral intuitions enable us to detect mathematical and moral facts. But if these two objections apply to beliefs formed on the basis of semic intuitions, won't there be a problem using the Reedian response described above? After all, that Reedian response appealed to epistemic intuitions. Won't it be circular and therefore problematic to respond to the skeptic about epistemic intuitions by relying on epistemic intuitions to confirm the trustworthiness and rationality of relying on epistemic intuitions? Before addressing that concern, let's consider a worry that this skeptic faces. The worry that using the underdetermination and mystery objections to support skepticism about epistemic intuitions is self-undermining. These objections rely on premises that are based, ultimately, on epistemic intuitions. So the skeptic appears to be relying on epistemic intuitions to argue that we can't trust epistemic intuitions. The skeptic might respond by pointing out that it's possible to learn that a belief source is problematic by discovering that it indicates its own unreliability. Richard Fumerton has this example where you ask the magic eight ball if it's reliable and it says no. You know that where you shake this little thing and then the word appears in the screen. And so you shake it and then it says no. And what Fumerton points out is it's not really encouraging to say, oh, but wait a minute, that would be, you know, it's saying that about itself, so I shouldn't trust it, so I can go back to trusting it again. I mean, that wouldn't be a sensible way to respond. And maybe that's the kind of move that the skeptic can make here. Not relying on epistemic intuition as a magic eight ball, but maybe trying to show those who do rely on it that it leads to trouble. That is a response worth taking seriously. But the question is whether in making such a discovery, the belief source should be mistrusted wholesale, or whether instead our mistrust should be directed more narrowly at the alleged indicators of the source's supposed untrustworthiness. The Reedian will be happy to acknowledge that our belief sources are imperfect. But in this particular case, she'll be inclined to think that the problem is with the epistemic intuitions behind the underdetermination and mystery objections, not with epistemic intuition as a whole. So let's return briefly to the circularity problem that afflicts the Reedian anti-skeptic, who relies on epistemic intuitions in forming the belief that her epistemic intuitions are veridical. Isn't that a damaging kind of epistemic circularity? The short answer is that relying on epistemic intuitions and forming the belief that one's epistemic intuitions are veridical needn't be damaging, even though it does manifest a kind of epistemic circularity. Sometimes epistemic circularity is benign. In particular, it is benign when the person with such intuitions neither is nor epistemically should be seriously questioning or doubting the trustworthiness of veridicality or veridicality of these intuitions. I don't have the space here to discuss any further this way of defending benign epistemic circularity, but I'd be happy to do that in the Q&A, and I've done some other work. Okay, section 3, responding to defeaters for non-inferential religious beliefs. There are many different kinds of religious beliefs. I'll focus just on the belief that God exists, or maybe beliefs that obviously entail it, such as God can help me, or God is not happy with what I've done, or God deserves my gratitude. I'll be concerned only with allegedly justified or rational theistic beliefs, since it's only those beliefs that have some kind of positive epistemic status that can be defeated. And I'll focus only on, or that allegedly have it, and I'll focus only on the non-inferential justification that theistic beliefs have. Theistic beliefs have. That isn't to say that they can't have any inferential justification. Theistic beliefs, like other beliefs, can have both inferential and non-inferential justification at the same time. But I'll be interested here in potential defeaters only for their non-inferential justification. And I'll be focusing on undercutting defeaters and not rebutting defeaters. A rebutting defeater for a theistic belief, such as a strong and persuasive argument from evil, if successful, would defeat all of a theistic belief's justification at once, whether inferential or not, or non-inferential. But an undercutting defeater can be more selective, targeting the trustworthiness of only one basis of a belief. For example, its non-inferential basis, or a part of its non-inferential basis, and not others, in cases where the belief has more than one sort of basis. Thus, I'll be focusing not on rebutting defeaters for theism, such as an atheistic argument from evil, nor on undercutting defeaters for inferential theistic beliefs, which would be, say, objections to the premises in a theistic argument, Instead, I'll be focusing on undercutting defeaters for non-inferential theistic belief, objections that attack or raise doubts about the trustworthiness of the ways by which such beliefs are non-inferentially formed or sustained. In examining how a theist can respond to these kinds of potential defeaters, I will limit my discussion to skeptical objections based on the underdetermination objection and the mystery objection. There are many potential defeaters from other objections as well, and I will comment on them briefly near the end, but there isn't this isn't space to discuss them all, so I've chosen to focus on the ones where the parallel with the previous discussion is the closest. Recall that the success of the responses to the skeptical objections discussed in section 2 is not measured by how satisfying those responses were to skeptics. Instead, it's determined by whether it's plausible for non-skeptics to think that the rationally required response to those objections is what the skeptics think it is, i.e. that the beliefs be abandoned. Many sensible non-skeptics who give serious consideration to the skeptical objections discussed in section 2 find it plausible that rationality does not require us to abandon the beliefs targeted by those objections. Similar remarks apply to the discussion in this section of theistic responses to skeptical objections. The success of the responses is determined not by how satisfying they are to skeptics about theism, but rather whether it's plausible for theists to think that rationality requires them to abandon their theistic beliefs in response to these objections. I'll be explaining why I think it's plausible for theists to think that rationality does not require them to abandon their theistic beliefs in response to these objections. The goal isn't to convince skeptics that theism is true. The goal is to present a defeater-deflecting perspective on skeptical objections to theism that can be viewed as plausible by a sensible theist, just as the goal in responding to those other kinds of skepticism is to present a defeater-deflecting perspective on skeptical objections that can be viewed as plausible by sensible people inclined to continue holding their perceptual, memory, mathematical, and moral beliefs. Get a pencil. Okay, so section A, 3A. As noted, only beliefs that have some, or allegedly have some, positive epistemic status can be defeated. I'll be thinking of cases where theistic belief is, initially at least, non-inferentially justified or warranted in something like the ways discussed by Alston and Plantinga in Perceiving God and in Warranted Christian Belief. Alston focuses on mystical perception, whereby God is allegedly perceived as doing something vis-a-vis the perceiver or as having some allegedly perceivable property, such as goodness, power, or kindness. These experiences may include something like the sensuous phenomenology associated with ordinary perception, but they needn't. Likewise, they can be mediated by ordinary perceptual experiences, but they needn't be. What's crucial for these experiences to count as perceptual is that through such experiences, it seems that it seems that the object of perception presents itself to the subject's awareness as so-and-so. Just as it seems that the objects in front of me present themselves to me when I open my eyes and look at them in a way they didn't when I was only thinking about them, so also in mystical perception, it seems that God presents himself to a person in a way he doesn't when the person is merely thinking or talking about God. Alston acknowledges and Plantinga agrees that mystical perception is rare. And Plantinga notes that certain things people believe about God seem to be unperceivable. I think he mentions as an example that God is a Trinity. Thus, Plantinga turns his attention to other sorts of grounds on which non-inferential theistic belief can be based. In addition to the experiences that are perceptual, in the sense that through them it seems that God presents himself to the subject as being a certain way or doing something, grounds of theistic belief can also include, and more commonly do include, theistic seemings. Just as mathematical beliefs are based on mathematical seemings, and moral beliefs are based on moral seemings, and memory beliefs are based on memory seemings, so also theistic beliefs are often based on theistic seemings. Many things can trigger theistic seemings. Feelings of guilt, or being forgiven, or desperate fear, or gratitude can trigger them. These are examples of Plantinga mentions. So can admiration of the grandeur and majesty of oceans and waterfalls and mountains and deserts and sky. So can appreciation of the smaller, intricate parts of nature. Another way theistic seemings can arise is in response to the spoken or written testimony of others. We encounter the testimony and what is said simply seems right. The testifiers seem to be worthy of trust. Theistic seemings can also arise from ruminating upon what we have learned about the immensity, complexity, mysteriousness, and possible origins of nature and of the human mind. Likewise, a consideration of the apparent design in nature, for example, in the biological world or in Big Bang cosmology, can produce a seeming that God designed these things, a seeming that isn't based on any argument from design and that is compatible with believing in evolution. These theistic seemings aren't the result of simply considering the proposition God exists and finding that it seems true, nor are they conclusions of argument. They are more like what Robert Audi calls conclusions of reflection, which are not based on inferences from premises, but instead emerge non-inferentially from an awareness of a variety of observations, experiences, and considerations over a long period of time. Thus, in a certain sense, the evidence I'm thinking of doesn't consist solely of theistic seemings. It also includes many recent and long past observations, experiences, testimony, considerations, and the traces of these retained in memory out of which these theistic seemings emerge upon reflection. It is often the case that we are unable to identify the precise origins of such conclusions of reflection, but as Ernie Sosa and Graham Oppie point out in other contexts, the fact that we can't trace the origins of our seemings arising out of reflection doesn't show that the beliefs based on these seemings aren't rational. I will proceed on what I think is a quite plausible assumption that the proximate basis or ground of non-inferential theistic belief is often either a mystical perceptual experience or a theistic seeming. Even if there is some more complicated history of consideration, testimony, experience, and reflection behind such a seeming, the accounts given of what justifies non-inferential theistic beliefs, so based, will be similar to accounts given of the justification of perceptual, memory, mathematical, or moral beliefs. Evidentialists will say that beliefs so based are justified if the beliefs fit the evidence on which they're based. Reliabilists will say that beliefs so based are justified if the processes by which such beliefs are formed are reliable. Proper functionalists will say that beliefs so based are justified if they are produced by properly functioning cognitive faculties in the appropriate cognitive environment. Insofar as theistic beliefs can be fitting responses to mystical experience or theistic seemings, and insofar as theistic beliefs based on mystical experience or theistic seemings can be reliably formed or produced by properly functioning faculties, non-inferential theistic beliefs formed on these bases can, according to these familiar accounts of epistemic normativity, be justified or rational. Okay, section 3b, bottom of page 3. The two undercutting defeaters discussed in section 2 can be applied as well in the case of theistic beliefs. The underdetermination objection notes that mystical perceptual experiences or theistic seemings don't guarantee the truth of the beliefs they incline people to accept. So in order to be rational in relying on such experiential evidence in forming theistic beliefs, this objection contends that one would need arguments showing that such experiences are typically, or at least on occasions of the sort in question, reliable. But there don't seem to be any sufficiently strong arguments for this conclusion, so according to this proposed defeater, we should be in doubt about the reliability of theistic beliefs formed on this basis. The mystery objection directed at mathematical and moral beliefs, yeah, and I guess, by the way, there's a similar worry here to the one that I mentioned with mathematical beliefs. If God's a necessary being, then there might be worries about how you can have that seeming and there is no God, but I think we can raise the worry despite that point, just as we could with a priori seemings about mathematical beliefs. The mystery objection directed at mathematical and moral beliefs also applies in the case of theistic belief, though perhaps not as forcefully. This proposed defeater points out that the mechanism for the formation of non-inferential theistic belief is not well understood in the way the mechanism for the formation of, say, visual beliefs is, nor is it clear how our minds could be responsive to immaterial things in the way they can be responsive to physical objects when we see things right before our eyes. The problem is somewhat diminished in comparison with the difficulty that the mystery objection raises for mathematical and moral belief by the fact that the immaterial object allegedly detected via the theistic seemings is a personal agent, not merely some abstract fact or truth as in the mathematical or moral realm. We have some understanding of how a personal agent like God could be the cause of theistic seemings, whereas it's not easy to see how mathematical or moral facts could be the cause of mathematical or moral seemings, since those mathematical or moral facts aren't personal agents who could arrange for us to be responsive to them. Nevertheless, the formation of accurate, non-inferential theistic beliefs seems much more mysterious and difficult to explain than the formation of accurate, non-inferential visual beliefs. Thus, the mystery objection can still say that because we have very little idea how we could detect the existence or features of an immaterial being like God, we have good reason to wonder if we really can detect such a being. And this objection can still press the point that until we can better explain how we can detect such a being, we should at least withhold judgment about whether we can detect it. As a result, the mystery objection provides us with another potential defeater for our non-inferential theistic beliefs based on theistic seemings. Okay, now the last page, the handout. The response to these proposed defeaters for non-inferential theistic beliefs is the same as it is in the case of perceptual, memory, mathematical, and moral beliefs. Let's focus on non-inferential theistic beliefs that are based on theistic seemings. And this is on the top of the handout. The proposed defeaters are that we should withhold theistic beliefs so based if either, one or two, if either, one, the seemings on which they're based don't guarantee the truth of the beliefs based on them, and we haven't got a strong argument showing that such seemings are reliable indicators of the truth of their contents, or two, we haven't got a fairly clear and detailed explanation of how our belief-forming mechanisms could detect such an immaterial being such as God. The response is that when reflecting on their non-inferential theistic beliefs, theists often have a higher order seeming, that is an epistemic intuition, that the theistic seeming on the basis of which they believe that God exists is veridical. It's not that the theist finds it absurd that any seeming on a religious topic could be non-veridical. Rather, when she ponders the particular theistic seemings on which her own theistic beliefs are based, she finds it implausible to think that they are non-veridical. It seems to her, because of an awareness of their felt veridicality, that these theistic seemings are veridical. And once again, something like this kind of response can be employed even by those who lack the philosophical sophistication to explain that they are responding in this way. Such people can still rely on higher order epistemic seemings to deflect these sorts of proposed defeaters for theistic beliefs. How strong is this higher order evidence? It might be tempting to think it's rather weak. After all, how can a mere seeming that another mere seeming is reliable be viewed as impressive evidence? But as we noted in the case of perceptual, memory, mathematical, and moral belief, such higher order seemings can be quite epistemically impressive. When we have strong seemings in support of simple mathematical beliefs, the higher order seeming about the verticality of these mathematical seemings is not flimsy and unimpressive. It is strong and constitutes a rational basis for believing in the reliability of our mathematical beliefs. So higher order evidence of this kind can be strong, but is it strong in the case where the first order seemings are theistic seemings and the higher order seemings are epistemic seemings that those theistic seemings are veridical? I see no good reason for thinking that it isn't fairly common for theists to reflect on their seeming-based theistic beliefs to find that it seems very implausible that their theistic seemings are non-veridical. Perhaps these higher-order seemings of the veridicality of theistic seemings aren't as strong as the higher-order seemings we have about the veridicality of mathematical seemings. Nonetheless, the higher-order seemings about the veridicality of theistic seemings could still be as strong as they would need to be to deflect the defeaters constituted by the underdetermination objection and the mystery objection. If these higher order seemings were that strong, that would nicely explain why many theists remain confident in their theism, despite being aware of these proposed defeaters, and despite reflecting on the fact that it's possible for evidence consisting of first order seemings to be unreliable. Keep in mind that we already have reason to doubt the epistemic intuitions on which the proposed defeaters rely, namely the epistemic intuition supporting thoughts that A, if the seemings on which a belief is based don't guarantee the truth of those beliefs based on them, and we haven't got a strong argument showing that such seemings are reliable indicators of the truth of their contents, then we epistemically should withhold judgment instead of believing. And then B, if we haven't got a fairly clear and detailed explanation of how our belief-forming mechanisms could detect things in some immaterial realm, then we epistemically should withhold judgment instead of believing. We have reason to doubt these epistemic intuitions because they support skepticism about our perceptual, memory, mathematical, or moral beliefs. And we have stronger competing epistemic intuitions in the form of higher order seemings about the verticality of the bases for these beliefs, counting against those varieties of skepticism. In light of that, the epistemic intuitions that theists have in support of trusting the grounds of their non-inferential theistic beliefs can plausibly deflect the defeaters arising from the underdetermination and mystery objections, which rely on the problematic epistemic intuitions in support of A and B above. As I mentioned near the beginning of section three, there are other proposed undercutting defeaters for religious belief belief besides the underdetermination objection and the mystery objection. For example, there is one, the objection from peer disagreement about religious topics. Two, the objection based on debunking social explanations in terms of parental or cultural influence of the origins of our religious belief. Three, the objection based on debunking evolutionary explanations of the origins of our religious belief-forming tendencies. And four, the objection based on debunking psychological explanations, for example, Freudian kinds of explanations or others from cognitive science of religion, about the origins of our religious beliefs. Each of these objections challenges the reliability or trustworthiness of the source of our religious beliefs and is therefore proposed as an undercutting defeater for our religious beliefs, intended to show that we should at least withhold these religious beliefs, even if it doesn't show that our religious beliefs are false. Objections parallel to these have also been raised against our moral beliefs, and in the case of the objection based on debunking evolutionary explanations, similar complaints have been lodged against our mathematical beliefs. It's a paper by Justin Clark Doan that pushes that line. And indeed against all the person's beliefs in cases where the person's beliefs include philosophical naturalism. This is planting this argument. I don't have the space here to work through the responses to these other four objections, and I realize that dealing with them may well be more complicated and difficult than dealing with the underdetermination objection and the mystery objection. The specifics of each objection will need to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. Nevertheless, in my judgment, a promising strategy to use in developing such responses would have at its core the Reidian response to religious skepticism that I've sketched in this paper, in my reply to the underdetermination objection and the mystery objection applied to theistic belief. Even if other points will need to be made to deal with the specifics of the different objections, the main strategy of the reply will come down to the same thing, namely that the theist can sensibly rely on her strong theistic seemings and her higher order epistemic seemings, confirming the veridicality of her theistic seemings in responding to objections that themselves ultimately rely on competing epistemic seemings. It's not as if responding to the defeaters is going to sort of make theistic belief rational. You need something else going for it, not just getting rid of things that go against it to make it rational. And so responding to these defeaters just by showing problems with them isn't enough for those beliefs to be rational, so this theistic seeming account is supposed to be part of what makes it rational. This might not be satisfying to skeptics about theism, but it might still provide sensible theists with a plausible way to deflect potential defeaters arising from a variety of undercutting skeptical objections to non-inferential theistic belief. Thanks.
Just to give me a feel for this, just a few questions about how the seemings work. I mean, one sort of case I was interested in is where the strongest seeming encodes nutty views about rationality. So you can think of possible creatures whose strongest seeming was a belief was rational but unreliable. And in terms of seeming trumpings, I mean, their strongest seeming says it's rational, but it's completely ridiculous view of rationality encoded in the seemings from the enlightened perspective. And just another thing, I'm wondering how to control for the vicissitudes of seemings. So if I take someone and run them through a skeptical argument so that they don't know they'll live the next week, and I get them to attend, well, you know, it's good to buy really cheap life insurance, right? And they go, yes, it seemed right. And I say, you know, it's good, you shouldn't buy life insurance if you know you're just, you know, wasting your money. And they go, I mean, at that point in time, their attentional focus isn't on they'll live for a week. At that point, their attentional focus is on the premises of my argument. It's not like, if the seeming is a conscious seeming, it's just not there at that point in time. So it's the picture that, well, at that point in time, their knowledge disappears, or their rational belief disappears, but then it gets restored when the Reidian seeming sort of comes back in all its glory, or is the sort of the propensity for that seeming somehow doing work?
On the latter question, so So think about the mathematical case. It seems to me that 1 plus 1 is 2, and then someone says to me, but couldn't that seeming be, untrustworthy seeming? And I think, no, it seems very clear that it's a reasonable thing for me to trust. But then you cleverly get me to worry about it in some way. And then the question is, suppose you do get me to worry about it, does the rationality of my belief in it go away, right? That's the question.
It's questions like that. I feel you're picking an example where you might be slightly more comfortable, but that's...
Yeah, that's where I want to start, more comfortable. Even if I am more comfortable with, there's still the question, do I want to say I'm still rational and thinking 1 plus 1 is 2 when you get me to have serious doubts about the reliability of my, suppose you manage to do that, get me to have serious doubts about the reliability of what I think I'm basing my belief on, namely that seeming. So suppose I do have those doubts. I guess my first response is to say I lose justification in the mathematical belief in those cases, and it varies.
You start knowing one-on-ones too, I guess.
Yes. There's one of the things about, what's this thing called? Phenomenal conservatism, where justification comes down to seemings. One of the worries about it is seemings aren't the kind of evidence that seem to remain, they seem to disappear. And so maybe, you could say, well, there's all kinds of times when it's not even seeming to you like 1 plus 1 equals 2.
Right.
Yeah. And so then I think a good way to improve that view would be, I'm not sure this would be a sufficient way to improve it, but at least a first step would be, you're justified in believing 1 plus 1 equals 2 if it seems to you 1 plus 1 is 2, or your belief is lodged in long-term memory via that, and then it hasn't been defeated, say, in these kind of ways. But there's the harder question, which you asked first, which was, we have these combination higher order seemings, which are sort of crazy, like, my belief is both reliably rational and unreliably formed, because that's what it takes to be rational, after all. I don't know what to say about those. I'm kind of inclined to say that it counts as a defeater and not as a help. But that's a tough
one. But it does complicate the
complicate.
Story.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think you were next.
Well, there's a follow-up?
Just do a follow-up on
that. Oh, yeah. Okay, follow-up.
So
yeah.
Just responding to what Jen said, and although it's not the focus of the talk, I don't think there's anything in what you say that means you say any old epistemic intuition or any old seeming is equally good. If you say something...
Yeah, I don't think that.
I mean, you could reply, maybe some, if I'm built, I've got really terrible seemings.
Yes.
They don't have any positive epistemics. I mean, it'd be perfectly consistent to have a kind of externalist account of what makes these seemings have positive epistemic status.
Yeah, and in fact, I did a couple of steps in my head as you were saying that. My first step was, yes, of course I should have said that, because I've defended this view elsewhere where I say not all seemings have this value. But then the further step is, I think of defeating beliefs or even defeating seemings, they don't have to be sensible ones to do their work. So that's a bit of a worry from my own view. On the topic.
Anyway,
thank you.
Yeah, so my question was along the same lines as John's, and I think in response to Liz, you clarified the way you were thinking about things, because it sounded like you were going for this account on which just the kind of psychological strength of the seeming is all that matters. And then I had worries that were sort of along the same lines, it just seems to me that for each predicate, there's a set of just those things that fall under the predicate. And then Russell comes up to me and, he says these paradoxes, I don't quite follow his reasoning, but the set theoretic axiom generating those paradoxes just seems to me clearly to be true. And then you'd say, because that seeming is stronger, I don't acquire the theater. And I was worried also about the kind of standard undercutting defeaters. It just seems to me that the object is red, and it just seems that seeming is vertical.
And it keeps seeming that way.
It keeps seeming that way, yeah. And the seeming that someone is telling me that they're straight gliding is just a little weaker than the seeming. view on which.
Yeah, no, I don't go for that view, and I didn't. Yeah, so I'm speaking in sort of an evidentialist, phenomenal conservative mode in a lot of ways in this paper, but I reject both evidentialism and phenomenal conservatism. But I think they can be, I think the sort of the overall picture is helpful, but it can be, it needs to be tweaked in certain ways. So in the case of what I'm inclined to, so let's see, the demon victim, things perceptually seem to the demon victim like they do to me. I want to say the demon victim is justified. It seems to me that, you know, that the axiom is true, or, you know, you put this stick in water and it looks bent. So it seems bent in a certain sense, but you also think it's not bent, right? Because you think there's a refraction explanation of that. There I want to say you have the seemings, you know, in support of the view that this is seeming is misleading, they undermine the justificatory effect of that first seeming, even though it remains. So I want to say that. So then there's the demon victim where things seem perceptually like this, and they believe that there's a room full of people. But there's also the other case of a person who has this visual experience that I'm having, and it seems to them that they're locked in a cold, dark basement, you know, in response to that. There's a kind of defectiveness going on there that I say prevents that seeming from providing justification for that belief. So sometimes it's going to matter, you know, the causal history of the seeming. I'm not sure it always matters, but sometimes it's going to matter. So that's a part of my view on the topic. So seemings are neither, and I also think they're not necessary for justified belief, but as pointed out earlier, I think they're not necessary and they're not sufficient for it. So just to, I'm not sure if that helps in addressing.
I mean, it does seem that you need to tell some story of when the seeming is appropriate. And then
yeah.
I guess the worry is that, you know, you have to just run the same dialectic again because, you know, the skeptic is questioning whether that it's appropriate
yeah.
to rely on that very seeming. So, you know, maybe the problem hasn't been.
Yeah, so in a way, this raises the epistemic circularity worry, right? And my thought on that topic is, if it's false that you do doubt the trustworthiness of your, say, your seemings, it's also false that you should doubt their trustworthiness, then it's fine that you're happily going along and trusting them. And your belief counts, you know, so long as it satisfies the other conditions in question. If you do doubt it, or if you should but you don't, then you're just kind of defeat going on. And the skeptic wrong, well, the skeptic's in trouble if the skeptic does doubt. And the skeptic's also wrong, I think, in thinking that we should doubt the reliability.
So I'm wanting to ask a question about the higher order seemings, about the reliability of your seemings. And question is the seeming merely that these seemings, the ones I've had, are reliable? Or does it include something else, namely that seemings qualitatively just like this are reliable? And I guess the reason I'm asking you about the second, this question is, if it's something like the second, then arguably peer disagreement will pose a different kind of worry than some of the other undercutters that you, if your interpretation of peer disagreement is that there are qualitatively
similar
seemings on the other side.
Yeah. So that's a huge topic, thinking about how this will respond to peer disagreement problems. But I'll just briefly summarize the kind of thing that I want to say about peer disagreement. I think we can think about internal and external rationality. And I'm thinking about this the way Plantinga thinks about it, where there's downstream from experience and prior to experience. So, and in fact, that's part of the problem with the person. Well, forget about that. So, you know, the demon victim downstream from experience might think things are going just fine. They're responding the way I'm responding, downstream from experience. Upstream from experience, things aren't going just fine. That demon victim would be internally irrational, but not externally irrational. Things could be even worse. The person could respond improperly to their, you know, things could go wrong downstream from experience too. In peer disagreement cases, you know, on religious or philosophical or moral or political views where you manage to get in discussion to some rock bottom intuitive disagreement. I guess what I think, here's a way things could go, and this is maybe the rosiest way things could go in a certain respect. Each of you is internally rational in trusting your seemings and in downgrading the other person to the, you know, to and thinking that other person's is making a mistake, innocently perhaps. You might even think that other person is internally rational, responding rightly to their seemings. Unfortunately, they don't have the right seemings. But you wouldn't think that you're both externally rational. There might be a certain, you could think you're, there's ways that it's possible for you to be both externally rational, which would be highly unlikely. But setting those weird cases aside, the natural thing to think is, at these rock bottom intuitive disagreements, we're both internally rational, that person's externally rational, I'm not. Of course, that person will think that of you, and you know that, but you still stick with yours. That's what I'm thinking is sensible.
So it has to be the case that the seeming that your seemings are reliable is somewhat independent of maybe this other commitment that seemings like this are reliable. They can come apart. You can drop the ladder view if you find this scenario where everyone's
what I was saying is you could actually hold on to that. Seemings, I was trying to actually concede that point in this sense. I grant that that person is internally rational. That person's responding the right way to their seemings. I'm responding the right way to mine. The problem is there's something going wrong with them having those seemings. Does that address what you're just asking?
Yeah, but if disagreement is widespread, then seemings of this type will not be
reliable,
right? So
yes,
if,
I see your point.
If it's seeming to me that my seemings are reliable is connected with, you know, the view that seemings of this type are reliable.
Yeah, then there'll be a problem.
Then there's a problem. So you need to be able to separate those out and say, well, the individual, these seemings are reliable, has to be in some sense independent.
Yeah, being told by your parents about what religion to believe is not a very reliable method, since there's so many conflicting views, you know, that you get from that method, and this is kind of like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right.
I would like to follow up on that. So I did a survey among philosophers of religion, asking them, you know, how do you come to your beliefs and did you change your mind? And it's an uncontrolled survey, but I did get 150 responses. And interestingly, the theists seem to be less sure. So they did express, you know, I was raised a Catholic and then I started doubting things and, you know, I got a niggly sense of what it's like to be an atheist. But then I sort of go back to my Catholic beliefs and this time, you know, more founded. And then you have like atheists who said like, you know, I always knew there was no God and like when I was a child and then, you know, and what's the philosophy, I've got proper grounds for believing it. So if anything, the atheists seem so, I don't know if this holds any, I mean, it's not a controlled survey, but so the seemings of the atheists seem to be stronger than the seemings of the theists. And this ties in with an earlier paper of Keith DeRose that was sort of circulating online where he said, you know, I have sort of gentle nudges towards the belief, but I don't really have a strong, you know, it's like it's knowledge. I don't think it's knowledge. It doesn't feel like knowledge. Like I'm seeing you here standing in front of, it's not that kind of seeming. So how would you respond to that? I mean, can the Reidian response still work?
Well, I guess I'm not convinced by those experiments that what you've said is true in general, because of how the experiments were run.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. I'm not convinced by Keith either, actually, that's a sensible thing to hold. But, you know, I mean, that's what he holds, so I guess I believe that. I guess I'm not sure. So one question would be, is it really true that a lot of theists operate this way?
That's an empirical question.
Yeah, but and I just pointed out that, you know, think about cases where there's a view that you've held for a long time, and someone proposes an objection, and you're not quite sure what to say about it. Like right now, no, I'm just kidding. And you think, well, look, if I think about it more, you know, I mean, you've got a sort of a nagging sense that it doesn't seem right to let go of this. I think of that as kind of a higher order seeming, at least in part, you know, about what's going on. And I think the resistance, you know, there's many possible explanations. I mean, this is what these undermining explanations do. Possible explanations for why people that seem otherwise, you know, to be intelligent people hold theistic beliefs. And of course, you know, for atheistic beliefs too, you can give varieties of explanations, but you know, one explanation is these kinds of seemings. And I'm not saying, I mean, I mentioned other religions in response to John, but yeah, atheists could make a similar move, you know, in defense of their atheism. And I think that would, you know, that would explain in a fairly charitable way why people are hanging on to their beliefs. So that's why I offer it. But you're right, it's an empirical question. It's sort of hard to know how we would test that question. I mean, there's all kinds of flaws and experiments that I think that we have to be careful about. But
It is kind of a follow-up, actually. I think it's quite quick about the epistemic intuition. So I just noticed this. It's kind of it's sort of picky part. It's quite important. So when you're talking about, you've got the I think it's this with perception. You've got the first order perceptual seeming,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got the second order seeming. And first, you say we become self-consciously aware of a seeming. It seems to us that the seeming is veridical. Actually, that seems to be quite plausible about perception.
So we're
but the, well, it's actually it's like about three quarters of the way down the first page.
Okay.
Like that. But it's one thing to have a second order thing that something's veridical.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite another to have a second order seeming that's formed in a reliable way. I don't think I have a second order seeming that my perception believes even this one, as it was reliably formed. And like, it just seems to be very implausible that we have seemings about reliable formation.
Mm-hmm. How about the seeming that it's not formed in a radically unreliable way?
Well, I mean, I'm now being invited to introspect about seemings, but
yeah.
I mean, I think that maybe, you know, I think it's plausible.
I think you're
right.
I mean, I agree with you.
Present, you know, this is how things are, this is veridical, but
yeah.
It's much more, you know,
it's a different thing.
A tendentious claim that we have seemings of reliability.
I agree that there are
people don't even think about, you know,
yeah,
that kind of thing
that's
in
right.
a self-conscious way.
So maybe, I think that's right, but I also think what happens in response to the suggestion that they're formed in a massively unreliable way is that we also think, no,
okay.
That's not what's going on. So it has to be drawn to our attention.
But maybe that's not a perceptual seeming, maybe it's just ridiculous. Because I mean, you've got seemings and you've got epistemic intuition. As I was
well, so the
a
idea,
bit of a rag bag.
So people don't typically have our higher order seemings, right? They don't typically have these higher order seemings. The person going to watch the movie might, for the first time, have had these higher order seemings. Hey,
mm-hmm.
but my perception's unreliable. But you can bring them to their attention, as we do in philosophy classes. And I'm thinking that, you know, you don't always have this higher order seeming, but when it's drawn to your attention, you do. And when it's drawn to your attention, what if your mathematical seemings are massively unreliable? You think, that doesn't seem right. I think that's not true. And that's sort of akin to thinking that they're formed in a trustworthy way. That's how I got to there. But you only get there by being prompted, I would think.
Okay, but it just seems to me that's just like a proposition that seems to you obviously false. It's not that there's, whereas I think perceptual seemings, when you have a perceptual seeming, it's not here's this proposition which just seems
no, but it's
true.
But
so
the higher but the higher order claim is a proposition about the
okay
the
okay so it was a proposition anyway okay
yeah.
Fine, but I think you need to be careful about that,
yeah,
because
I think
you know
there are different
depends
yeah
on the detail.
So there's still followed by Matt.
So I suppose that you want to say, given things you've actually written elsewhere, that if you have any seemings of whatever kind, and then you actually are coming to think about whether you have a higher order seeming, and your higher order seeming is like, I have no idea what to say about my first order seemings,
yeah,
that you have a defeater?
Well, if it's this, that you, I have no idea whether, you know.
Especially if sorry, let me just clarify.
That's fine.
The higher order thing might be something like, I have no idea what to say about it. In particular, I don't know whether I have to call it reliable,
yeah,
coherent, or what. I mean, we might often have the sense that, well, my seeming is coherent with like all my other background beliefs and my other seemings, perceptual, intuition, stick in another way. But that's not going to get me to reliability understood in the right way. So when you start really thinking in terms of reliability, you might have across the board agnosticism at the higher level.
Yeah, if you did, I think that would, so I'm inclined to think that's a problem. So if you thought, you know, if I say I believe there's a bottle over there, and then you ask me, you know, do you think why do you believe that? Is it because of your visual perception? And I say, yes, it is. And you say, do you think that way of forming that belief is reliable or unreliable? And I say, I have no idea whether it's reliable or not. I mean, if I'm really considering that question and I think I have no idea, then I think that should give me worry about that perceptual belief. I think it would be silly for me to say that. I think people feel pressure to say that because they're worried about the next question. How do you know that? How can you prove it? You know. But in actual fact, people think, it is, yeah, I guess I think it's a, that's a thing that's sensible for me to trust. Now that you mention it, yeah. I hadn't been thinking about it. But if I really sincerely thought, I have no idea, I'm withholding judgment on that, I think that that's a worry. Yeah. And in the religious case, so I have this paper on religious disagreement coming out in the Oxford Studies in Philosophy of Religion series. And at the end of it, I talk about, what about those who don't have these higher order seemings? You know, what's going to happen with them? And I think what I just said, that they have a defeater for their theistic beliefs based on theistic seemings, unless they're supposing there's something else that's supporting those theistic beliefs. But there's talk in religious circles or Christian tradition of the gift of faith, right? And the gift of faith could be a kind of, I think these doubts about the higher order seemings aren't rational to have, but they're tempting to have, especially in certain kinds of contexts, maybe philosophical contexts. But I think they're not rational, but the gift of faith might be to protect us from that kind of irrational doubt about the higher order seemings and enable us to hang on to the theistic seeming beliefs.
So the part of your paper about epistemic circularity, it seems like what you're doing is you're addressing a skeptic who is complaining about this whole framework wherein you can render reasonable judgments about epistemic principles using epistemic intuitions, and the skeptic complains that this is circular. And I was wondering if whether or not there could be a different kind of skeptical complaint that actually you use as a kind of reply to the skeptical complaint, that this complaint is somehow self-undermining. And I wonder if a skeptic couldn't turn that back on you and say, actually, the real problem with all of this framework of using seemings as your sort of primary way of doing epistemology, epistemic seemings, is that the epistemic seemings pull you in all these different directions, right? They don't really seem to sort of line up in any single direction and point to any single set of principles. They're just sort of leading you all over the place. And that, understood in that way, it's really sort of a homonym to the common sensus, right? That, look, common sense actually is just this incoherent mess of epistemic intuitions. And so for that reason, you can't sort of come up with any non-arbitrary way of settling on some subset of the epistemic intuitions as the privileged one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think one way you might have out of this is to go more externalist, right? And I think that's probably what you'd favor, but I was wondering if you had other sort of thoughts on that issue.
Yeah. So this is, I think about Chisholm's stuff on particularism. I think about how people, what happens when people give counterexamples to utilitarian views, right? They say, here's a case that your view says this is the morally right thing to do. That's clearly the morally wrong thing to do. And there are intuitions behind the utilitarian principles that are attractive, but there are also intuitions in support of this counterexample being a counterexample. And so it's a pretty common kind of problem in philosophy, I think. And I guess, I think the way we handle it is some are much stronger, and we go with those. Now, suppose they were equally strong, then we might just think, yeah, I'm confused, I don't know what to think. That might happen, right? But suppose in your case, these are much, much stronger. If that's true,
is just psychological.
Yes, confidence. If that's true and the external stuff is also in place, two external kind of things. So by the way, internal rationality and external rationality, I understand both of those in an externalist way, right? To respond the right way to downstream from experience is the externalist account of what counts as responding the right way downstream from experience, and likewise beforehand. If in that externalist sense, you're responding the right way downstream from experience to have a much higher confidence level than these and a much lower one than these, then that's rational, internally rational. If in addition, those strengths of seemings are also upstream from experience produced in the right way, then there's external rationality too.
Actually, I'm sorry that you said.
It's been addressed. I'll pass.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, was there anyone who, did you have your hand up for a long time?
Yeah, if I can.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was wanting to pick up on the starting discussion with Maria. So you said that not any seemings would justify. I mean, in fact, I had this kind of worry, maybe with wishful thinking, something. It seems to you that something will happen because we want it to happen. Mm-hmm. And many of these models say this is not justification. Mm-hmm. So let's call the non-justificatory seemings the dodgy seemings. And then you have the view that, if I'm right, that dodgy seemings, they don't justify, but they can defeat. So you
yes.
can have defeat based on dodgy seemings.
Yeah.
And then, since the paper is about defeaters of defeaters, it seems you go also for the view that dodgy seemings can defeat defeaters. And then I was wondering, is it a bit like a too much asymmetry or too cheap, like in a sense you can get a positive justification for a belief you need a good seeming, but to restore positive justification to a defeated belief, and maybe a belief that was defeated by something very reliable and good, you just needed a dodgy seeming.
Yeah, so a few things. One, I'm not talking about defeating defeaters, I'm talking about deflecting them, so they never get to be defeaters in the first place. But on defeater defeaters can work in a number of different ways. One way they can work is to make the defeating belief seem irrational. So suppose the defeater is a belief, and then that belief becomes irrational. Say it was rational before. So you had a justified defeating belief, right? But then that belief comes to be irrational because of a defeater for it. That's one thing that can happen, but it also can happen that it doesn't become irrational, but it loses its defeating power with respect to this other belief. Even though it remains rational, it ceases. You know, there's a complicated story, as you can tell, where it no longer bears on the thing originally. But we're talking about an irrational belief to start with, right? An irrational belief that's a defeater. How can an irrational belief be defeated if only things that have some positive epistemic status? If only they can be defeated, right? You can't defeat something that's already unjustified. Well, here this defeater is unjustified. How can it be defeated? Well, it can't be defeated in the sense of losing its justification, but it can be defeated in the sense of ceasing to have its defeating power. So there's two. So I'm not sure if that addresses all that you were asking about. Maybe you also asked about the asymmetry, right? Is that like, so why
can't... I was just thinking, so for instance, an application is whether, suppose you have, you have theistic seemings, and then you have these arguments that, raise doubt about them, but then you have this wishful thinking that your theistic beliefs are reliable. Is that enough to deflect skepticism about your theistic feeling? Just having, by wishful thinking, you mm-hmm. want your theistic beliefs mm-hmm. to be truthful.
Yeah. Well, so on that last case, suppose you have theistic seemings that are in fact, say, at least internally rational. And then you maybe have a lousy argument against them, or I don't know, I guess suppose you have a lousy argument against them, against trusting your theistic seemings. That could still be a defeater if you accept its conclusion, I say. But then suppose that via wishful thinking, I say, that's probably not a good argument, okay? I think in that case, what you've done is you've irrationally removed an irrational defeater, and things are just fine. That's kind of a weird case, but here's another case. Suppose I have a very good argument against my theistic seemings, and then I bring in wishful thinking. So I said that you have a defeater if you do or should think your thing's untrustworthy. Well, here's a case where you don't, but you should, because this is a good argument, and it's only wishful thinking that got you out of it. So irrationality can remove other kinds of irrationality and leave you back in the good situation, but irrationality can't save you from something that should be defeating your belief.
So you had
upon a couple ideas that have been touched so far. So I understand that uncertainty about whether my theistic seemings are reliable would sort of render me unjustified informative.
It depends how significant the uncertainty is, but yes.
Right. And the idea is that a seeming, a really strong seeming, that those seemings are reliable could kind of combat that uncertainty.
You mean a real strong seeming about my theistic seemings could come back to the uncertainty about the theistic seemings?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I'm wondering if a strong seeming that those are reliable is the only thing that could get that done.
Mm-hmm.
So what's wrong with a picture where, you know, you'd see I have theistic seemings, I don't have a really strong sense that those I don't have a really strong seeming that those seemings are reliable, but, you know, because I have strong theistic seemings, I have a strong belief in God. Let's say I know there's a God, and then I, you know, come to deduce that he wouldn't deceive me, and that's why my theistic seemings are reliable. Does it have to go by sort of an additional stronger seeming?
No, I don't think so. But I guess I'm, I hope that's not how things are going for you, because I don't want to disturb your belief in God, but I don't think that there are strong arguments of that sort.
Well, I don't have strong higher theistic seemings, so.
Yeah, so maybe we'll, so that's, either way it's a problem, yeah. I mean, a person, yeah, I mean, that might be right. It's an empirical question. I think it's hard to find out, maybe even about oneself, whether one has these higher order theistic seemings. But just like, you know, you could respond to the problem of perceptual skepticism with a knockdown argument against the, you know, for the reliability of perception that didn't rely on perception, that would be a way to go. So also what you're mentioning would be a way to go in the case of, in the theistic case, but it might not be that there are such arguments to use.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, I think one last question, or should we just stop?
It's up to you.
Okay, so we'll have one short question. Yeah, really, really short.
Yes, little question.
Just follow up on the, just a question related to whether dodginess is in the head. Suppose we agree that dodgy but very strong seemings can't deflect in the way that non-dodgy strong seemings can deflect. Would you be tempted to think that a duplicate of you in an atheist world isn't, after all, justified because we're using dodgy, albeit strong seemings?
Well, so there's dodgy and there's dodgy. Internal, there's internal and external dodgy.
I know.
Okay,
I
what
know.
Kind are you talking
you're
about?
You're externalist about even inter.
I know, but I. Which
you're
kind of dodginess?
You're externalist about internal dodginess.
I am.
Right.
And what kind
so
of.
I'm asking you straight up, given your externalism about internal dodginess,
yeah.
Would you think that a duplicate of you in an atheist landscape would be using dodgy but strong intuition?
Internal dodgy? Is that what you mean?
Yes, I'm
yeah.
talking about.
I'm sorry, okay,
dodgy.
Sorry.
Yeah, I internalize.
I think that the duplicate of me would be, would be justified. So they wouldn't be dodgy. They wouldn't be internally dodgy, they'd be externally dodgy.
But not internal. I see. And you're thinking in general internal dodginess supervenes on your noetic and seeming structure?
It's partly So sometimes I give the example of things visually seem to me like this, and then I have this visual experience. So I'm separating visual experience from seemings. I have this visual experience, and it seems to me I'm in a dark basement. That seeming, I don't even have internal rationality in response to it. It's kind of there's a problem that got infected. But how about with memory? Is there a similar, can we tell a story like I just told with memory? Maybe not. Maybe it just starts with the seeming in the memory case. And maybe in the theistic seeming case too, right? And so maybe it's just going to be the strength of the seeming is going to be enough to, you know, this is Mike Humer's view that the seemings is what, it all comes down to the seemings. And I guess I'm inclined to think internal rationality might in some cases just come down to the seemings, I suppose.
Okay, thank you very much.